From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Above normal snowfall and below normal temperatures have increased the risk for flooding in the state this year. So could we be facing a repeat of the flood disasters of 2008? We'll put that question to hydrologist Jeff Zog of the National Weather Service in Des Moines. Then we'll be joined by Rich Patterson, director of the Indian Creek Nature Center, and urban conservationist Wayne Peterson with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. We'll learn about rain barrels and other things each of us can do to curb the effects of flooding, the outlook for floods in Iowa, and what you can do about it. First, a look at this hour's news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad to have you with us to join us over the noon hour. I am so done with this winter. Well, how many times have you heard a comment like that in the past week? As we wait out the final weeks of winter to feel the warmth and joy of spring, many in the state are filled with trepidation as well, wondering what will happen to our rivers and streams when all this snow melts, when the spring rains come. So this hour, we want to take a look at potential flooding in the coming weeks and months and what is being done to prevent a repeat of the flooding disasters of 2008. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Rich Patterson, director of the Indian Creek Nature Center in Cedar Rapids, and also urban conservationist Wayne Peterson with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. They'll tell us about some things we can do that's being done to curb the effects of flooding, both short and long term. But first, a few days ago, the National Weather Service issued its second spring flood forecast. It shows the risk for flooding has gone up since that first flood forecast back in January. Joining me now, hydrologist Jeff Zog with the National Weather Service in Des Moines. He's in our studio in Des Moines. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Hi there, Ben.
What is the latest risk of flooding this year? What is the outlook?
Well, as you said, Ben, the risk of flooding has definitely increased from our first outlook that we issued in late January. We're looking for an above normal risk of flooding statewide, and we're most concerned about portions of northwest Iowa, especially the Des Moines-Raccoon River basins, as well as portions of southeast Iowa. That would be the Mississippi River from the Quad City area downstream, as well as portions of the lower Wapsipinicon, Cedar, Iowa, and Skunk Rivers.
Mm-hmm. These specific areas that many of our listeners are perking up their ears right now because they may be along those rivers. Why those specific areas? What factors come into play?
Well, we look at a lot of factors when we try to assess the risk of flooding in the spring. I think the most obvious factor is the snowpack. I don't need to tell people that we have a lot of snow across the state right now. And the snowpack is deepest, especially across northwest Iowa. Some of our cooperative weather observers have observed snow depths in excess of 40 inches across northwest Iowa, which is much above normal. So that's one factor. Another factor is the stream levels. They're running above normal for this time of year. And another big factor is the soil moisture. The soil moisture has been running high all winter. In fact, it's increased since December statewide. We're running much above normal. So that makes the risk of flooding very high across northwest Iowa, where all those factors come together. And then in southeast Iowa, the reason that we're looking for an increased risk of flooding on the Mississippi River is because of the tributaries. With all the tributaries running high, eventually the Mississippi would run high too.
Mm-hmm. Are there any areas of the state that don't look too bad in terms of the outlook, the risk factors?
I would say the portion of the state that looks the best relative to the risk elsewhere across the state would be far northeast Iowa. That would be the upper Iowa River Basin and some other areas across far northeast portions of the state. Pretty much anywhere else across the state, the basins we talked about and even the Little Sioux and the Floyd River up in northwest Iowa, they're also at risk of flooding.
Mm-hmm. Up in northeast Iowa, I know last year they received a tremendous amount of snow. Not so much this year. Dubuque had 80-plus inches last year, didn't they?
Right, yeah. There was some tremendous snowfalls across northeast Iowa. And this year we're seeing the bulk of the snowfall, or the heaviest snowfall, focused across portions of northwest Iowa, although portions of southeast Iowa did get into the action this past weekend with the snowfall.
When you at the National Weather Service, Jeff, say risk of flooding, what does that mean?
We're looking at the chances of flooding. Basically, it's just a percentage chance, and we relate that to normal. And when we say there's a high risk of flooding, that's high relative to normal and just the probabilities. You know, for example, on the Des Moines River Basin, a good portion of the Des Moines River Basin upstream of Des Moines, we're looking at greater than a 98% chance of hitting flood stage. And in some locations, we're looking at a greater than 98% chance of hitting moderate flooding, and some locations in excess of 80% chance of hitting major flooding. That would, again, be across portions of the Des Moines Raccoon Basins and even the Little Sioux River across northwest Iowa.
Mm. So how does this compare with this time in 2008? Can we make some parallels?
Well, we can. However, I want to caution people that we're comparing apples to oranges here. The outlook that we're looking at right now is weighted really heavily towards the snowpack. And at this time back in 2008, there was very, very little snowpack across the state. In 2008, what caused most of the problems by far was just the amount of rainfall that fell in May and June. It wasn't so much the snowpack, because there wasn't much at this time back in 2008. The soil moisture was high this year, as it is in 2008. But again, it was just the rainfall that occurred in 2008. I guess one point I could use to make an example is you look in Cedar Rapids on the Cedar River. Our last spring flood outlook that we issued back in 2008, we were calling for a 17% chance of hitting flood stage through mid-June. And we all know what happened in Cedar Rapids.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an example showing that the spring flood outlook is weighted very heavily towards the snow that's on the ground right now, not so much to the precipitation, although in 2008 it was very, very high-end type rainfall.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about timing. When will be the most likely time that we'll see flooding in these areas?
What we're looking at right now, Ben, is the most likely time would be from roughly mid-March into late April, and different rivers and portions of Iowa will flood at different times. Of course, the rivers across the south, central, and north portions of the state would flood earlier than the Mississippi River, because most of the flooding from the Mississippi comes from snowmelt up north.
Mm-hmm.
However, this year, if we get enough snowmelt, it could push the Mississippi up before the snow melts up in Minnesota and Wisconsin later on. So roughly mid-March into late April.
These are pretty scary predictions you're making, Jeff. How accurate have your predictions, the National Weather Service's predictions, been in the past?
That's a very good question, Ben, and that's one of the things we try to look at, because we want to see how accurately we're forecasting things. And from what I've seen by going back and looking at past spring flood outlooks, if you take out really high-end events like the heavy rain that we had in 2008, these outlooks definitely get into the ballpark as far as what we're going to see in the spring. One of the things that we look at when we make these outlooks is we look at the past 40 years' worth of temperature and rainfall information, and we reset our river forecast model to the current conditions this year, and we run all those past years through it, you know, basically 40 times, once for each year. And when we say the risk of flooding is, say, greater than 98%, what we're saying, in effect, is that every single one of those model runs we made, 40 out of 40 model runs, produced moderate flooding.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives us a pretty high degree of confidence. If we're looking at the past 40 years' worth of information, we've captured a lot of variations, and every single one of those variations produced flooding. So we're pretty confident that we're going to see flooding. It's just a matter of how severe it is.
When you run those models again and again with different variables, what are the things you are changing out?
What we're doing is, say we run it the first time, we reset it to the conditions that we have this year, the snowpack, the soil moisture, the river conditions, among other factors. And then we run the observed temperature and rainfall data through for the first year. Then we reset it, run it again for the second year. So we're looking at temperature and rainfall information and seeing how the river responds in any given year.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jeff, here you go. Now, give us the worst or best case scenarios. I don't know, should we start with the worst or the best?
Well, we can start with the one that I hope we see, and that's the best case scenario. And that would be a case where the snow melts gradually, where we don't want to melt all the snow all at once.
And we don't get a lot of snowfall in the meantime to add to what we have.
Exactly. We already have a lot of snow right now. We're basically in the top five, if not close to the top five, in terms of snowiest winter so far. And March is our snowiest winter on average anyway, so we're not even into March yet. Mm. We're already near the top five. But what we'd like to see is a slow snow melt, little if maybe any precipitation. Because we're already wet, we don't really need a lot of added rainfall. We just don't want to overwhelm our rivers.
Mm-hmm. And let's go to so we need a nice gradual snow melt here and a little bit of rain during the spring, not much if we can help it. So go the other way. The worst case would be more snowfall, a very snowy March, and a dramatic quick melt-off.
You have it, Ben. You pretty much took the words right out of my mouth. What we don't want to have happen is add more snow to what's on the ground. We stay below freezing for an extended period of time, and then we warm them up really quickly, melt the snow really fast, and then get a lot of rainfall on top of it. That would really overwhelm the rivers and definitely cause a lot of problems.
What weather patterns are you looking at right now, or is that the indicator that's most important that you're watching in the coming days and weeks?
Well, when we look at the NOAA climate outlooks, they really don't give us any added information as far as what to expect for the next 1 month or 3 months. So in the short term, it looks like we are going to stay below normal in terms of temperatures, probably not as cold as what we're seeing today statewide, but definitely below normal. Normal for this time of year, by the way, is basically in the mid to upper 30s across central portions of the state, probably lower to mid 30s across northern portions of the state. But however, we're looking at signals of a pattern shift in mid-March where the weather pattern may shift out of our cold temperatures that we've seen and warm up closer to normal. So it looks like our first good chance of seeing a pattern shift would be in mid-March. How much of a warm-up we would have, we'd have to wait and see. The scary thing, though, is that normal temperatures, by the time you get into mid-March, are in the mid to upper 40s.
Mm.
So if we warm up even to normal suddenly, we're going to start melting a lot of snow very quickly. So that's one thing we'll have to keep a very close eye on.
So temperatures in the 40s would qualify us as for a quick melt-off, and we would like to see them in the mid to upper 30s for a slower melt-off?
That's correct, Ben, yeah. Anytime you get into the 40s, especially mid to upper 40s, you run the risk of melting snow very quickly. Of course, the warmer it gets, the more rapidly you melt the snow. We'll just have to keep a very close eye on it. I would like to see temperatures in the mid to upper 30s during the daytime and even dip below freezing at night so you don't have 24 hours, if you will, of snow melt. You kind of release a little and then hold it back and release a little. That's what we'd like to see.
Talking about the flood outlook for 2010 and flood prevention with Jeff Zog of the National Weather Service in Des Moines. And when we come back, we'll keep Jeff here. Please stay put, Jeff, in our studio in Des Moines, and talk more about the flood outlook and prevention. We'll be joined in just a moment by the director of the new Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa. This center was called into being after the dramatic floods of 2008. What are your questions and concerns about flooding? Do you live along a river? What specific questions do you have? We'd like to have you join our conversation this hour. 1-866-780-9100, our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Above normal snowfall, below normal temperatures have increased the risk for flooding in Iowa this year. So this hour, we're talking in depth about the flood outlook for the coming weeks and months and some prevention as well, especially in our second half hour. We have Jeff Zog with us, the National Weather Service in Des Moines. Joining us now, the director of the new Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa, Witold Krajewski, is with us. Professor Krajewski is a civil and environmental engineer of 22 years at the University of Iowa. And good afternoon. Welcome to our program.
Glad to be here.
Now, this is interesting. I didn't know much about the Iowa Flood Center before looking at the information today, but you're not even a year old at the Flood Center, are you?
That is correct. We started our operation on July 1, 2009.
Mm-hmm. How did the Flood Center come about? Why was it called into being? It's, of course, connected with the dramatic floods of 2008.
Definitely. Those floods were a very frustrating professional and personal experience, especially for us at IIHR, Hydroscience and Engineering, which is a research institute in the College of Engineering at the University of Iowa. We have many experts in the institute who study rivers and water flow in the environment, hydrology. The best we were able to do was to carry sandbags, and
that's the extent of what you could do at the flood. So you thought there must be something else a hydrologist can do.
Exactly, and so soon after the flood, Larry Weber, the director of the institute, and myself, we proposed establishing a center through which we could focus our research more on the problems in Iowa. With the help of senators Hogg and Balcom and Dvorsky, the Iowa Senate has established, you know, the center with the starting date of July 1, 2009.
Now, in your mission, you monitor Iowa's waterways. Is that it? What have you done in this very brief history of the center to help us in the future cope with flooding?
Well, the Iowa Flood Center is an academic research center, so you can think of this as a technology transfer. So the expertise and the research that we have been conducting for a number of years that is relevant to floods and flooding and hydrology in general, we can transfer some of the results of such research into the local problems. And so,
do you have an example of what can be, from the theoretical to the practical, that we can transfer?
Well, a very important component of what we do is development of floodplain, you know, mapping, you know, that requires detailed surveying of the river channels and then developing hydraulic models of open channel flow, how water flows in the rivers, and then combining this information with all the structures that are along the rivers and developing a map, if you will, of how much water would flow out of the banks under certain discharge conditions. So we have developed a number of maps like this for a number of communities. So this is directly, you know, relevant to flood forecasting in real time. If you have such information, you know, available and accessible via a website to the public.
Yeah, go ahead and mention your website.
Well, one can easily find it by just Googling Iowa Flood Center.
Iowa Flood Center, okay.
And so it's actually iowaflatcenter.org, all one word.
Okay, very good. We want to reach out to our listeners to see if there are questions and concerns about flooding. Of course, concerns, that's not a question at all. But what are your questions and concerns about flooding? 1-866-780-9100 or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Witold Krajewski with us, the director of the Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa, Jeff Zog of the National Weather Service in Des Moines, both with us for a few more minutes. Let's go to Craig in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Craig. Were you impacted by the floods of 2008?
Yeah, I lived one block from the river on the northwest side of Cedar Rapids, and I had 11 feet of highly contaminated water in my house, and I lost everything in a day.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And but the good Lord's been really good. And my concern is there's so many people that have rebuilt this. When I talk to all the different entities, there is so many things to consider when beefing up the existing flood protection system. It is so expensive. And now if it's going to flood again, what's going to happen to all this hard work and all these people that are down there living again in the vulnerable areas? If I got flood insurance again and I'm not even living there, how much would the National Flood Insurance cover a house that is flooded again in 2 years? Let's say I insure it for $100,000. would they actually pay me $100,000 for a property that was flooded 2 years ago?
I'm thinking we don't have the expertise at the table here with Jeff Zog of the National Weather Service. If we do, please, Jeff or Vitol, jump in. But we don't have insurance experts. I understand your concerns, and our conversation, understandably, this first half hour is very distressing to people who, like you, Craig, who have lived through this. To hear these predictions with a great deal of certainty that we are going to very likely have some flooding. Jeff, any words of response to Craig? Jeff Zog of the National Weather Service in Des Moines?
Yes, can you hear me, Ben?
Yes, you're on. Go ahead.
Okay. What I was going to say, Ben, is, you know, I'm definitely not an insurance expert, but what I'd encourage Craig to do is go to the website for the National Flood Insurance Program, and that's floodsmart.gov, floodsmart.gov. And there are a section talking about frequently asked questions, and there may be information on that website, and there's also phone number contacts for Craig or others to call and ask those questions. I definitely don't want to say anything that's incorrect, so I'm not going to answer it directly other than refer him to that website and maybe make some phone contacts.
We'll cross our fingers. Craig, thank you for your call, and we hope that you don't have such an experience again. Jeff, Craig's call reminds me of what something you must take into account, or do you discuss this at the National Weather Service when talking about flood warnings, flood predictions? Do you have to walk a line between being absolutely accurate, which you want to be, but not being alarmist, having people break out in a sort of a panic?
Oh, that's definitely a concern of ours, Ben. There's definitely a social component to our flood warning process, and we really try to balance that with the science. We try to go out with a high degree of certainty in our forecast, and one of the things we're going to eventually do is provide a cone of uncertainty in our forecast. Right now, we just provide just one number. And what we're planning to do in the future is do similar to what they do for hurricane track forecasts, where you have the expected path, but then you have that cone showing the possibilities. And that's one of the things that we're really working towards, to show people, first of all, what we really think is going to happen, but then what are the possibilities, so they can see, you know, is my concern at such and such a stage, maybe it falls within that cone, so they can see for themselves.
Vitold will be with us in the second half hour. Jeff, I know you have to go very quickly before we do take a break. In what ways are we better prepared, even though the predictions for flooding don't look good, are we better prepared than we were in the spring of 2008?
I can speak from the perspective of the National Weather Service, and we definitely are. The National Weather Service did a national service assessment after the floods of 2008. There are some definite recommendations that came out where we can do a better job. One of the problems we had in 2008 was chasing the rainfall day by day. We now have the ability to use more than one day's worth of rainfall in our models, and we also have some better ways to communicate and collaborate between other National Weather Service offices and our partner agencies. So the communication and the science has definitely improved since 2008, so we're on even better footing now.
Jeff, I want to thank you for coming into our studio today, and we'll keep our fingers crossed and keep our attention on the National Weather Service with your flood predictions. Thank you, Jeff, for joining us.
Thank you, Ben. It's been my pleasure.
Coming up on The Exchange, we'll look at ways in which we have the ways in which we have developed our urban areas that have contributed to the potential for flood, and what measures we might be able to take to lessen the impact of flooding. That's when we return. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And I'm Ben Kiefer, and we're back with The Exchange today. Tomorrow on this program, we examine two recent cases where college students went missing, one at Iowa State University and one at the University of Iowa, and the questions these cases raise about how reports of missing students are handled. My guests tomorrow will include the Dean of Students for both universities and the Director of the JED Foundation. That's an organization dedicated to protecting the mental health of college students, tomorrow on The Exchange. Today, though, we are looking at the flood outlook. As you heard, if you tuned into our first half hour, the National Weather Service has issued its first spring flood forecast. That was the end of January. Now its second forecast days ago show the risk of flooding has gone up. In our first half hour, hydrologist Jeff Zog of the National Weather Service in Des Moines told us that the snowfalls have been above normal, the temperatures below normal, so that has pushed up the risk for higher flooding. And this half hour, we want to look into the ways in which we have developed our urban areas that have contributed to the potential for flood and what measures each of us might be able to take to lessen the impact of flooding. Joining me in the studio, Witold Krajewski. He is the director of the Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa. We have a couple of other guests joining us, but before we do, I want to turn to Professor Krajewski and ask some more things that the Iowa Flood Center is doing that we didn't get mentioned in the first half hour. For instance, you're working on instrumentation so that we can measure water levels, flood water levels in our streams, lakes, and so forth?
Yeah, that's correct. We are developing two projects with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and the Iowa Department of Transportation to install inexpensive sensors on the bridges. The sensors will monitor the, will measure the distance from the bridge deck to the water level. So, and this is the most, you know, direct variable as it relates to flooding.
And up to this point, you have to have someone, you've had to have someone go physically out on the bridge and lower a, or lower something to measure it, right?
Well, actually, the network of stream gauges that is operated mainly by the United States Geological Survey works in a different way. These are automated stations, but their installation is rather, and maintenance is rather expensive. And that's why within the state, there are only about 150 of them. And the data collected at those stations are the basis for the National Weather Service streamflow forecasting. And so now what we are proposing is to install much less expensive sensors on the bridges. And in the state, we have about 25,000, you know, bridges.
Wow. So now, a lot more data.
A lot more data, potentially, of course. Initially, through those two projects that I mentioned, we are looking at deployment of about 100 of those sensors. And they will be providing information on small streams, those that are traditionally not monitored by USGS. And, of course, everybody knows that it is the small streams that feed into larger ones, and those flow into the rivers, and as Jeff mentioned before, eventually to the Mississippi.
So in the future, when we have all this data, all these sensors out there all across the state, we could have that accessible by the general public. We could go to a map of the of Iowa and look. You could zoom in on any area and see the real-time levels of streams and rivers at any time.
That's exactly right.
Tremendous.
That's our, you know, vision. Again, it may not be 25, you know, thousand, but any number would help, and it would provide additional information to what we know right now.
Professor Krajewski, we talked about weather models in the first half hour. That was in the context of the National Weather Service. You work with weather models as well. How are they different than the ones for forecasting whether we're going to have a rainy spring or not?
Well, our models are short-term forecast, you know, models. So the story starts with rainfall. So rainfall is monitored with weather radars, and those instruments provide detailed information every 5 minutes or so. There is quantitative information on rainfall intensity, and this, again, what Jeff Zog, you know, mentioned, you know, before. This information is fed into detailed models of runoff production at the scale of a hill slope, and then how the water runs from the hill slope into small streams and then throughout the entire drainage network. Again, small streams and larger streams, you know, and
the
so
behavior
on.
The behavior of the water once it's on the ground.
That's exactly, you know, right. So the major, you know, difference is from the National Weather Service, you know, models is that our models work at smaller scales. Skillful forecasts remain a challenge. Water flow in the environment is a very, very complex, you know, process.
Witold Krajewski is the director of the Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa. Less than a year in existence, called into existence because of the devastating floods in 2008. I'd like to have two other guests join our conversation as we look at the potential for flooding this year in 2010. Rich Patterson is the director of the Indian Creek Nature Center outside of Cedar Rapids, or in Cedar Rapids, I'm not sure which. Rich, hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Also joining us, Wayne Peterson. He's an urban conservationist with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Joining us also by phone, I believe, Wayne, you're in Dubuque. Good afternoon.
I am, Ben. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Let's start with you, Wayne, if we could. I want to talk, have you talk us through how we got here in the development of our urban areas. How have we, in building our neighborhoods, our shopping centers, increased the chances of flooding?
Well, when we do new development, we do a couple things. Number one, we tend to do what we call land disturbing activities or grading. Sometimes we bring in fill or we do cuts or we move the earth around. And in the process of the grading, we tend to alter and compact the soil profile, which means less water can go into it. And then the other big issue is that we create impervious surfaces, surfaces that shed water rather than allow it to soak in.
Parking lots,
roofs, streets, and then, of course, compacted turf areas will shed runoff, too, after absorbing a small amount of rain.
Do we know how much this urban development, in any measurable way, quantifiable way, has increased our flooding? How much of the flooding of 2008 were we ourselves responsible for instance?
Well, I wrote a couple chapters for Kahneman Utell's book that's coming out any day now that addressed the floods of 2008. And in a major river basin like the Cedar or the Iowa, there's a relatively small percent of that drainage area that's urbanized. And the data I looked at was from 2002, the DNR land use data, and it indicated about 4 to 5% of the Cedar River Basin was urbanized. And, you know, I've also heard estimates it might range up to 10%, but obviously the urban landscape wasn't shedding the majority of rainfall that caused the flooding. But when you get to localized streams like Indian Creek that the Rich's Center sets on, now we have a much smaller drainage area, and I'm not sure what the percent of urbanization is in Indian Creek, but I know it's been rapidly urbanizing in recent years. So flash flooding on Indian Creek is really directly impacted by the impervious urban surfaces and the increased volume of runoff that we generate as we create impervious and compacted landscapes.
Rich Patterson, I remember last summer taking a walk through your beautiful Indian Creek Nature Center. Last fall, I think, when the Tallgrass Prairie area was just beautiful, just over my head, in fact, in some areas. But I did notice that many months after the flood of 2008, it was clear that the damage in your trails is still there.
Yes, that's true. We had the floods of 2008 that caused damage, and then we had the other one in August of 2009, the flash flood that came down Indian Creek that did tremendous, awesome damage to the lower part of the creek and bridges and all kinds of other things.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about ways that flooding can be mitigated, even if it's just in a small way by each of us doing something. And I'm referring, Rich, to rain barrels, because I know the Indian Creek Nature Center has been had a project here where you want to get people get rain barrels in the hands of people. Tell us about that.
Well, it's really a lot more than that. And one of the things that we quickly learned from people following the floods is that the actions that are being done by government and even the flood center tend to be long-term. They're important, but they're long-term. They're a little abstract, and they don't require individuals to do much of anything. And we detected a real hunger and eagerness among people to do tangible things right there in their yards or properties that might help, even if a little bit. And we were looking for an Earth Day project and focused on rain barrels. And quite simply, a rain barrel is a vessel, a container that catches some of the water that would come off of a roof during a rainstorm event and allow you to hold it for a while. And then a week or two later, when it's dry, you can use that water to irrigate your your tomato plants or your lawn. Every gallon that you hold in that rain barrel is a gallon that won't go down the driveway and then down the road and into the storm sewer and quickly contribute to a flood surge downstream. So we announced this, and it was met with very, very strong positive response by people who just seemed very much wanting to do something, and this gave them a chance.
Okay, so can people find out about purchasing rain barrels, more about them through your center or a website?
Well, the best way to find out about our project is on our website. You can just Google Indian Creek Nature Center, and the Rain Barrel Project will come up right on the front homepage there. But you can also just Google rain barrels just in general, and you'll come to lots of resources. There are many places that you can buy them. You can also make them, and the concept is there. And our object is not so much to sell lots of rain barrels. I mean, we hope we do, but we really would like to get people interested in doing things in their yards and to buy a rain barrel from somewhere or make one and put that in and then maybe take another step and construct a rain garden in their yard and then maybe replace the asphalt with permeable paving and then maybe do like we did out here on in the property and replace this lawn turf that doesn't absorb all that much with a little bit of prairie that will accept a lot more rain into the soil. So the rain barrel maybe is just a start of a number of actions that people can do in their homes and yards to reduce runoff. And if one or two people do that, that's fine. That'll help just a tiny bit. But if 10,000 or 100,000 or a million Iowans do it, it can have a real impact.
Rich Patterson, director of the Indian Creek Nature Center, also Wayne Peterson with us, urban conservationist, and Professor Witold Krajewski, the director of the Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa. If you have a question for us, your questions and specific concerns about the flooding picture for us in 2010, please do join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Wayne Peterson, from your view as an urban conservationist, how much impact can rain barrels have in mitigating our floods?
Well, I want to support what Rich said. I think it's the first step in a comprehensive treatment train type of process that we would encourage people to pursue. And, you know, if you don't mind, I'll throw a couple little numbers at you. If you owned a 20,000 square foot lot, which is about a half an acre, almost a half acre lot, rather typical sized lot, you would receive around 400,000 gallons of rainfall in a typical year, which means you'd need about 8,000 rain barrels if that all came at once. Of course, it doesn't all come at once. So now let's take this down to the house. If you had, say, a 2,000 square foot house, which is a little on the big side maybe, for each inch of rain, you would get about 1,250 gallons of rain of water per inch, which means you'd need about 25 rain barrels to capture an inch. So yes, it's a small first step, but as Rich said, I always encourage people, if they're buying a rain barrel, that it typically has an overflow hose, and decant that overflow into a rain garden, and a rain garden typically can manage a much bigger rainfall event. Well, at least they can they're usually designed to handle a little over an inch of rainfall.
Very, very quickly, we have callers who want to join our conversation. Wayne, Rich also mentioned these rain garden, these other things. Mm-hmm. What are the other steps very quickly that people can take on their own property?
Sure. One of the simplest and most comprehensive things they can do is do what we call soil quality restoration. And by that, we typically are doing two things, trying to increase macro pore space in the soil through either plugging with an aerator or a deep-tined aeration system, and then complementing that with a compost application to increase organic matter content, because the organic matter content of the soil links to the amount of rain that can be absorbed. So raising the organic matter content of your soil resources is a real good way to absorb more rain and shed less runoff. Mm-hmm. You can look at the permeable pavement alternative for driveways, the rain garden, of course, and then the rain barrel is kind of that first step back towards cistern technology that I'd like to see us move to as a society. And I do think rainwater harvesting will be a big thing in the future.
It's interesting you mentioned about the organic matter. I mean, when we sometimes when you have housing developments, as where I landed, someone came in and scraped
yep.
all of that away, and we have a bunch of clay there, which
yep.
doesn't absorb very much water, does it?
No, nope, and that's a very common practice, and I think EPA is going to put a stop to that, and there's also been state legislation proposed that would require some soil quality restoration with new development.
Wayne, are there examples of places in Iowa that are doing a good job of this new type of urban conservation?
Mm-hmm, yeah, and I always talk about where I had my breakthrough promoting these concepts. That was up in the Okoboji Spirit Lake area. And, of course, those communities have an economy that's dependent on tourism, which is dependent on good water quality in the lakes. So they were the early adopters.
Mm. And how are we going to measure success here?
Well, I think there's probably going to be regulatory actions in the near future. At least I'm hearing rumblings of that coming down from EPA. But what I really hope we can demonstrate in the future that by utilizing green infrastructure to do sustainable stormwater management, we will find some economy there, some actual cost savings, certainly over the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can save money while doing something that's ecologically beneficial, I think that'll be a win-win, and it should sell itself.
Are there resources from the state or federal government to encourage this environmentally sustainable development?
Yeah, there are some grant programs. We recently, through DNR, had some of this iJobs money, the bonding money from the state. And they had a $1.4 million grant program to do stormwater projects that featured infiltration-based practices. And we had a great response to that. There was a request for twice the amount of money available. And so we got a very diverse number of projects that will be going in throughout the state this coming construction season. And then I like to talk about the little town of West Union up in Fayette County. And they are in the process of planning and designing a Main Street revitalization program. They're a green street pilot community, and they will be installing, basically rebuilding Main Street and using permeable pavement and bioretention or rain garden type practices. And they'll be able to capture through infiltration up to 90% of what, you know, we used to talk about as the 100-year storm. Now we like to call it the 1% storm.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, that's going to be a really powerful green model, and hopefully they can get that underway this summer.
Wayne, Rich, and Vitold, let's go to callers, squeeze in one or two. Jerry is joining us from Pleasant Valley. Good afternoon, Jerry. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to mention that not only the urban areas are responsible for the flooding, but also the way agriculture has changed throughout the state in the last 50 years, we've gone to a different type of farming where we used to have a lot of small farmers, and they raised oats and hay and a variety of crops. And now we just have corn and soybeans and all these row crops that all we have now is really a big source of flooding, erosion, and quick runoff.
Wayne, how often do these interests of urban and rural conservation come into conflict, or we more or less have the same goals?
Well, that's been one of my goals throughout my 30-plus years in the field of soil and water conservation, is to build urban and agricultural coalitions for conservation and for watershed protection. We really need to see the urban and the rural sectors working together and not pointing fingers. So, yeah, we're working hard to get everybody rowing together on these issues of reducing the flood potentials while simultaneously protecting or improving water quality.
Wayne, I want to get to Rich and Vitold with a closing comment here in a moment, but what rules would you say right now could we really improve the short-term outlook or mitigation of flood if they were enforced? Do we have rules or laws that we need or just aren't being enforced?
Well, not really for stormwater management yet. Right now, the major requirement is to manage water sustainably to the maximum extent practicable, which, can be interpreted in a lot of ways. But like I said, I think there probably will be some standards set in the future that will be required to be met when we do new development. But a lot of this is going to be voluntary as well. If we do everything right with sustainable water management with all new development, we have this big, big, big job of going back and retrofitting the built world that was done in a way to divest of rainfall. And so retrofitting will be a lifelong endeavor for a generation or two.
Rich Patterson, it reminds me of visiting the Indian Creek Nature Center. We see Iowa, what it must have looked like in previous generations before the settlers came here. And we're taking our cues from the way Iowa used to be, setting it back a few centuries, hopefully, right?
Yeah, that's very true. And our example here, where we have restored prairie in places where agriculture allowed all of the topsoil to go downstream, basically all the organic matter from the soil out on that old hillside farm is long gone, but we have restored prairie there and taken that from an active runoff area 20 years ago to a place that runs off hardly anything now, and at the same time those prairie plants are building the organic matter in the soil. So just like what Wayne said a few minutes ago, we are using native vegetation to increase the health of the soil and decrease the runoff that's coming off it.
Okay, very good. We have run out of time. I want to thank you for being our guest this hour. Rich Patterson, director of the Indian Creek Nature Center in Cedar Rapids. Wayne Peterson with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Wayne is an urban conservationist. And also joining us, Professor Witold Krajewski, the director of the Iowa Flood Center at the University of Iowa. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. And it's been an enlightening and hopefully not too scary hour for our listeners, for me included. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Jeff Schmidt, along with Alex Hoy. I want to go out with a little music by an Iowa artist about the weather, but to also mention our producer assistant today, Christina Sarnelli, technical support from Dennis Reese, podcasting on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's go out with a little new music by Iowa singer-songwriter Ben Schmidt. This is his new album called Silt. The song is Rain, and I'm sure you'll be able to relate to it. The spring is a-comin'. Thanks for joining us.
Rain falling on the rooftop.